Okay, so the lights are up, the signal for me to open my mouth. And this evening I have three requests for talks. So I'm going to mix them all together and make one talk out of three. And the first topic, is actually all these talks, as many of you may know, they get put on the internet, go all around the world. The first one was from a lady in, oh, I think it was somebody in Texas, and they were saying they're really, really concerned about the oil spill in the Gulf. So what do Buddhists do about oil spills? So that's number one. The second one was, they were saying, there's a fellow in Melbourne, and they were saying they get really interested in Buddhism, but their father is a member of Opus Dei. They're really strict Catholics. And they say, what's the middle way? You know, should you be flogging yourself, or you should be like Ajahn Brahma, just sitting there drinking cups of tea all day? So what's the middle way between indulgence and just asceticism? And the last one was the easy one. Somebody in Indonesia said, all this Buddhism which they read and they studied, and it's all concepts. How do you put that conceptual Buddhism into daily life? And of course, those of you who've been coming here for years know that this is actually what we do every Friday night, to take these teachings of the Buddha and put them into practical terms so that you can use them for your daily life. Now, that is not shortchanging Buddhism. It's not interpreting Buddhism. It's actually just right straight down the line teachings of the Buddha, but putting them in a form which everybody can understand. I know my Buddhism. I don't interpret it. I was also like the scholar of Buddhism as well. That, you know, early on in my life as a monk, you know, I sort of learnt Pali, I taught Pali. That's the language of Buddhism. And I was like the expert, especially on the Vinaya, and taught lots and lots of people, not just ordinary ways of dealing with life, but taught the monks how to sort of their rules of monastic rules, and some of the other concepts of the Dhamma. This is a teaching. So I've got my scholarly credentials as well. But there's one teaching of the Buddha which he said, which all of you know, who know a little bit about what the Buddha said. The Buddha often went on public and said, the only thing I teach is suffering and the end of suffering. So the problems in the world and how to solve them. And that's actually the basic teachings of the Buddha. You know, how to solve your problems and the fact there are problems there. So every Friday, you know, I just talk about problems in life and how to solve them, just as a Buddha would do. So this is not just, you know, something different than core teachings of the Buddha. This is actually core teachings, suffering and the end of suffering, in sort of all the different levels of suffering. So we take things like how to deal with disasters. And just that oil spill in California is just one disaster among many. Many people's lives. You might look at your life, and my life is just one disaster after another. My life too. All your lives. So how do you deal with disasters? And how can you also interpret this middle path as a way of dealing with the disasters of life? And I'm sure that you've had your disasters. I've had my share of disasters. Oh, what was one of my earliest disasters? One of my earliest disasters was when my girlfriend dumped me. Oh, that really hurt when I was a young man. So how do you deal with that disaster? You know, it's quite obvious how you deal with that disaster. You know, just whenever something wrong happens or bad happens, the only reason why people get upset, angry, afraid, is because they just focus on just one part of the problem. They don't see the big picture. The big picture for me was, now I'm free. You know, I don't have to please this woman anymore. I can do whatever I want. And you know, there's many advantages of not having the girlfriend. And also, you know, I could actually save a bit of money instead of spending it. In those days, when you took a girl out, you had to pay. And some of these girls, they just really wanted the very best restaurants or whatever. But anyway, now I didn't have a girlfriend. I was totally free and I could meditate some more. It was wonderful. So that's what I, you know, when I my girlfriend dumped me, I thought, "Phew, I'm free. Thank you so much." And maybe for the rest of my life, you know, you always see the positive side of so-called disaster. When something goes wrong, there's always something else happens which is useful and which is positive. You know, one of the biggest disasters, you know, we had years ago was when the Bodhinyana Monastery burnt to a cinder, a big bushfire. In, I always remember this, it's burned into my memory. January the 31st, 19, what was it? Not that burnt down. It was January the 31st, I know. See, I've let it go. 1991, that's right. 1991, a crown fire. Now, this was a disaster. And especially for me, for those of you who've been here a long time, you know that I built that monastery in the early days. You know, that my name is on the building license of many of those structures. You know, and not just overseeing it, you know. I used to say that, well, you know, this is a saying that many Sri Lankans know, that in many books they say that Buddhism is such a pacifist religion that we don't go to wars, that no blood has ever been shed in the cause of Buddhism. That's wrong. I shed my blood so many times that my DNA, my blood stains are probably on all of those early buildings. You know, you hit your finger with the hammer, you cut yourself with the sharp steel on the roof. So my blood is on all of those buildings over there, and I'm quite proud of that. But what it really means is I worked so hard building that place. I mean, really hard. You know, no builder would work like that. You know, the unions would be on your back if they knew how hard I worked. Not only that, that if Amnesty International just knew how hard we worked in those days, the Buddhist Society of Western Australia would have been sued. You committee in those early days, you exploited me to the max. But no, I really enjoyed being exploited. It's nice being exploited. Please exploit me. But it all burnt down. At least that's what I thought. It's a crown fire. This was the hottest day ever recorded in Western Australia, in Perth area. There was another day, which be there, it was about 46 degrees before the fire came. Imagine what it was like when the fire was burning. About a month or two, a couple of weeks later, there was it got even hotter than that, and it's never exceeded those temperatures since. And a big fire came through. You wouldn't, for those of you who have seen those big crown fires, the trees don't burn, they explode! A big bang! And it's like bombs going off. And it's really scary. But we had to evacuate. Now, it's amazing disasters. When people evacuate, it's amazing just if it can go wrong, it does go wrong. The second wisest person in the world next to the Buddha was Murphy, with his Murphy's Law. If it can go wrong, it does go wrong. I mean, that guy was almost enlightened, whoever that guy was. And you know what happened? In the middle of the fire, okay, so he took shelter in the main hall. And the fire officer came and said, "Get out, get out, it's going to get worse." So we all went into the cars. And there was this one guy staying there. I'll never forget this guy. He's actually a very funny guy. His name was actually Mohammed. He was a Muslim, but he turned into a Buddhist. And he told me that when he was over in Kuala Lumpur, he went to a Buddhist talk there. He was just working his way to Australia. But you know, in Malaysia, that Muslims aren't allowed to listen to a Buddhist talk. So he was just actually filling up his car at the gas station. This is just an anecdote, nothing to do with the talk, but it's a good anecdote. He was filling up his car with gas at the gas station. The guy was just talking to him, said, "Oh, where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to the Buddhist temple, listen to a nice talk tonight." And then that attendant, he called the police. And the police came and said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, well, I'm just filling up my car, I'm just going to a Buddhist temple." "You can't go to a Buddhist temple, you're a Muslim." He said, "No, I'm not, I'm a Buddhist, I've converted." He said, "What's your name?" "Mohammed, you're a Muslim." So as soon as he came to Australia, he changed his name. So I think he gave a Buddhist name. I think he called himself Amaro or something. But anyway, he had to change his name because otherwise, you know, once a name like, you know, Muhammad, you have to be a Muslim. But anyway, he sort of changed. But during the fire, just about 1 minute before we were told to sort of evacuate, he decided to change his trousers. Now, why people do this in the middle of a bushfire, I do not know. But as we were running for the car, he literally was caught with his trousers down. And I can never forget that. Flames all around. You know, people sort of panicking. And there's this guy just putting on his trousers and jumping into the car with his, you know, pants showing. Underpants, that was. But this was a disaster. And seeing those trees explode, and knowing just, you know, I built all those buildings, I really thought that nothing would survive. I really thought that. It was a disaster. We were evacuated down the bottom of the hill on the Southwest Highway. And you could look up. You could look up to the forest where the monastery was. Explosion after explosion. The other monk who was there at the time, Ajahn Jagrua, he was actually visiting down the southwest, and he actually came, and he didn't know we'd been evacuated. And he actually tried to get up the hill. There was a police roadblock. And he said, my monks are up there. It's my monastery. I've got to go up there. And the police said, no. And he said, look, I'm going. And they said, no. And then one of the trees exploded, and the policeman said, you want to go up there? And he said, okay, I'm not going. I mean, it was really dangerous up there. And you see all those trees explode, and I thought that was the end of the monastery. But it was a disaster. 8 years of hard work vanished. But, you know, the attitude of a monk is because maybe just our attitude, which, you know, you learn from being a Buddhist. Okay, easy come, easy go. 8 years of hard work. And tomorrow I was going to get started again. It doesn't matter, because disasters. The real problem with disasters, it's not just the fact you have bushfires. It's not the fact you have things happen like a oil spill in the Gulf. It doesn't matter there's a tornado or there's a volcano or, you know, you lose your girlfriend or your husband finds a mistress or whatever. Now, the disaster really is just what you do with that. What I call the middle way. The middle between you and that disaster. There's a disaster, there's me. Now what's in between the both of us? How am I relating to that terrible fire? And it's because I've been almost like brainwashed as a Buddhist for so many years, because it's just really soaked into me, right to the bones. When these things happen, you know, it's, I think, a disaster, you can't change that. But what am I doing about this? What's my reaction to it? What's my relationship, you know, between this tragedy which has happened? And something which the Buddha said, something which is so powerful and wise, I cannot stop disasters. I cannot change the world. I cannot control that world outside. Bushfires happen. It's not a case we're going to prevent another bushfire at our forest monasteries. Another bushfire is going to happen. We know it's going to happen, so we prepare for it. You know, oil spills happen. You know, that husbands sometimes are unfaithful. You know, if you've got a good one, well done, lucky. Count your blessings, but sometimes they cheat on you. That's men's hormones or whatever. You know, and women, they nag, nag, nag. That's just what they are. I don't know. That's what people tell me. I'm just going on what they tell me. So don't blame me. So whatever these things are, it's just, this is our world. We can't really control it. But what we can control is the way we deal with that life. We can control our relationship to that life. We can control that space in the middle between us and the world we have to experience. And that, to me, is like the really interesting middle way. Just what's between you and that disaster. So I always put something positive in there between me and that disaster. And when you look at something positive, you can always actually see that there's always some silver lining under any cloud. And obviously the obvious silver lining with the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is people must start looking at alternatives to fossil fuels. Just they're running out, and actually to get more, they're so dangerous and so technologically difficult to extract from the ground, and these spills are going to happen. And because of those spills are going to happen, you know, that we have to look for other forms of energy, green energy, or not just green energy, we have to learn how to use less, to conserve. We have to have less people on the planet. That's one of my biggest things, because more people means more things to consume, which means more oil, more resources, more forests being cut down. And it's obvious. That's why the government, whenever they start to talk about climate change control, they should put aside a great deal of funds for having more monks and nuns, because we don't have kids. So because we don't have kids, we lessen the overpopulation and thereby actually solve a lot of the climate problems. So, you know, we should have, you know, the Futures Fund, you know, for future monks and future nuns, less children and a more happy lifestyle. I think that's a wonderful thing. And so hopefully the Buddhist Society of Western Australia can put in for a large grant. But there's obviously a positive that's going to come out of that. But the problem with people, and this is what has always fascinated me, why is it when there is a disaster, people have such a hard time of looking for the positive outcome of that disaster? Why is it that when, you know, that somebody does die, you know, people can't see the positive side of that, you know, like the inheritance? Oh, come on, you can laugh. I'm just being cheeky. No, when somebody does die, you know, you can see the positive side of it, you know, that they've ended a beautiful life. You all know that simile, the concert which I keep on talking about. When my father died, you know, he's only 44 or something, 45. And I was only 16 at the time, and I loved that man. But when he died, it was like the end of a beautiful concert. And so the positive side of a loved one's death to me was just looking at the wonderful years we've had together, the 16 years. What a great time that was we had. And it wasn't a disaster for me, because I saw the positive side of it. I'd actually had that man as my father for such a long time. That was brilliant. Thank you so much. I had so much gratitude. So a lot of times whenever a disaster happens to me, I have that gratitude. It's wonderful. I had actually the chance to build that monastery up for 8 or 9 years before that fire came. Thank you for that privilege. And I never thought, wow, all that hard work has gone. Because I couldn't stop what happens in life, but I could actually change my attitude towards it. So a lot of disaster management, you can't change a disaster. These things happen. But what death happens, you know, relationships, they do split up. So if they last, you're having a really good time. Well done. You really worked on it. You deserve that. Congratulations. But if it doesn't work out, it's not really your fault. These things happen. Disasters happen, so we can't control and stop disasters. Obviously, we can try and limit them, but they will still happen anyway. But where we really have full control is the way we relate to them. So when that fire came, I just let it go. Yeah, it was a wonderful opportunity to build a monastery, and I'll start again the next day, and it was amazing. As many of you know, the next day we went up there, even the bushfire brigade was surprised that all those buildings were still there, and I was just so surprised, you know, that even that story went. I went, the head of the bushfires service in Perth, it wasn't Fieser in those days, it was something else, but the head honcho came along and I had to take him around, and I still remember, I can never forget this, taking him around one of the huts, and he was looking underneath around it, inspecting it, and then he turned around to me and I'll never forget his words. He said, "Brahm, this should not be here." As far as he was concerned, you know, it was a miracle that it shouldn't have been there. The fire was so intense, most of those buildings should have been destroyed. But, you know, they weren't. Maybe you might say it's some magic, some sort of divine intervention or whatever, but, you know, they survived. But that wasn't the point. I had a nice test there, a disaster, something which was very close to me, and I could just let it go. Because to me, it was just the process of building it was important. It wasn't the fact that it was completed. It was a process. And as many people keep on telling you, you know, in those self-help books, and this is straight from Buddhism as well, it's not the destination, it's the journey which is the most important part. It's a process. It's not what you achieve, it's always how you achieve it. And it's that how, the process, that is the most important thing in life. So it doesn't matter if there's a disaster, that means just, you know, you just have to keep the process going. Of just trying to work hard, to be kind, to be gentle, to make sort of a better world for ourselves and other people. And we can always keep doing that. So the disaster, the real disaster, is not the oil spills, it's not the tornadoes, it's not the earthquakes. To me, the disaster is when people get angry and give up hope or seek revenge, when they really don't create the beautiful process of life. And they're just so goal-orientated that when they get frustrated or when things don't go according to their plan, they react in guilt, anger, revenge, negativity, depression. And those are the real disasters. When I call those disasters, these aren't sort of physical things. This is the mental stuff inside the human being. And when the Buddha talked about suffering and the end of suffering, he said, look, suffering isn't out there in the oil spills or in the earthquakes or in the sort of global economic crisis. No, the suffering is not in the stock exchange. The suffering is in just one's ability not to just to be at peace and to accept these things. The real disasters is people's anger and upset and greed and hatred and revenge. That's the real disasters in the world. So real disaster management is getting one's act together to realize where the problem is, and it's this middle thing here between you and what you're experiencing. And that is where you have full control. That is where you can really make a difference. It's not the oil spill which is a problem. It's the way people react to it. It's not sort of losing your partner. It's the way you react to that. What's between you and that loss? What's between you and that disappointment? And you can even look upon it as like a sort of, in a spatially, here's you, out here is the problem. And in between you, that's where the process of life happens. All life is a relationship. Relationship between you and the problems you have to face in life. Relationship between you and all the events which happen. That's why this is one of the tricks of giving a public talk. When I give a public talk here, I was giving talks, I'm giving talks all over the place this week. Whenever I give a talk, it's not about me and it's not about you. It's about what goes on in between us. So whenever I give talks, that's where I put my attention. As if you're out here, I'm here. It's what's between us. That is where the action is. That's where life happens. To me, that's the middle way. And that's where I have full control if I know how to do this. To put this beautiful sense of like kindness, positivity between me and each one of you. And when I can actually do that, so there's all sorts of insights can open up, positive insights. So whenever there is a disaster, what we put in there is negativity between us and that disaster. So we see the oil spill, so all the negative things which might happen, we just cannot see anything positive about that. When there is a bushfire, we think, oh, just all the destruction, isn't it terrible, isn't it awful? But I see the regeneration of the forest there. I see it's another opportunity to do something really wonderful and good. And for any of you who've been here long enough, you find that what for other people would be just so devastating, would let them see disaster. How can you deal with that? With the right attitude, you have a totally different way of looking at life. You have more options. And those positive options are obviously things which can solve problems, move the world forward, move you forward in a more happy, successful way. Oh, what was that? One of those early friends who was at our monastery in Serpentine years ago, he would sort of go from monastery to monastery, spiritual place to spiritual place, just like, you know, like a temple hopper. Just like when I was a kid, you know, used to do pub crawls. He would do like monastery crawls from place to place. And he was visiting us, and he had hardly any possessions except the only possession worth anything was his Harley Davidson bike. Some of those are worth a lot of money, and he was just so proud of his bike. And that was his the thing he'd actually saved up for, the only real possession he had, and also gave him freedom so he could just put his few other belongings on the back of his bike and go to Melbourne, go up to Cairns or come over here. So he was like free, except for his Harley. I remember he wrote to me and told me this story. He parked his Harley in a shopping centre. I think it was over in Sydney somewhere. And he went to buy a few things. When he came back, his bike was gone. Someone had stolen it. He said it was the only thing he owned which was worth anything. And he'd been Buddhist for long enough. He knew that was attachment. And he said, you know, all that's mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from me. That's a word-for-word teaching of the Buddha. All that's mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from me. And now it's happened. I've lost my Harley. And he said he just let it go. He was just so at peace. And he was so proud of himself. The only thing he really owned, he could just let go. It was wonderful having you, Harley. We had some wonderful rides together. I hope whoever has you now has a really good time with you. Off you go. And he was just felt so free and so peaceful. And it was only then when he was congratulating himself, he realized he was on the wrong level of the car park. And he went down the correct level and his Harley was still there. So he won twice over and he was so very proud, yes. And I passed the Buddhist exam, but I still got my Harley, you know, whoopee. But the moral of that story was it was a loss, it was a disaster for him. Maybe, you know, for you it's not that much, but for him that's all he owned. For me, the monastery, which was all I had, maybe for you, your life is all you've got, but if it's a time to give up the body, sick, death or whatever, what are you going to do? It's the biggest disaster of all when you're about to die. Car crash, cancer, whatever. What are you going to do? It's a disaster. Death is not the disaster. It's just how you relate to that. And exactly what relationship you have with that dying process. And you can always put something beautiful in there. What a great time we've had, body. And I'd had such a good time. And we did so much good work, you know, we volunteered to join the committee of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. We helped clean up, you know, after Friday nights. We, you know, kept our precepts. I'm going to heaven. Whoopee, let's get this over and done with quick. What are you worried about dying for? When are you going to go to a wonderful place afterwards? Yeah, come on, bring it on. I don't know why people are so afraid of death. They must have done some terrible things in their past. No, to think they're afraid of death. But whatever it is, it's your relationship. Have a positive attitude towards your dying. You know, once you're dead, because look, if you live too old, I mean, have you been to the old people's homes? Is that where you want to end up? So if you're blessed with a cancer, wonderful, I don't have to do that anymore. Now, what I'm saying over here is you can always have a positive spin on anything. Now, I'm not just saying you should just always have the positive spin, but you should always balance whatever's happening in life with something positive. And when you can balance something positive with the negative, then you're having a wise response to the disasters in life. Yeah, it's going to be a terrible problem, that oil spill. It's going to cause so much destruction of the animals and the fish and a lot of hardship. But there's always something good comes out of it. I just remember my parents talking about the Second World War in London. And that was big disaster. The Blitz, bombs going off every night for day after day for months. I remember even my mother, you know those... If you've been to London, you know, the terraced houses, you know, the two ups, two downs, they're only about, sort of, I don't know, was it 10 metres wide? In these big rows of houses, with 10 metres, that's a bit too wide. Two ups, two down, maybe about 4 metres wide, 5 metres from house to house. The house next door got a direct hit with a bomb, all the neighbours killed. My mother and my grandmother were inside, got cut. And that was just really close. You know, the bomb right next door. But these Brits in that time, they just had this incredible attitude to what was happening. So they didn't actually get traumatized. I knew my mum ever since I was born. She wasn't traumatized by that. So it's a wonderful, actually, attitude you can have to disasters. They just took it, and they just accepted it. And they worked together. The people who survived valued their life, and they cared for each other. It was amazing just how many people of that time, this is, you know, the generation before me, would actually say just what a wonderful time that was when everybody did help each other, that somehow there was a silver lining in that tragedy of being bombed during that wartime. So that there is a possibility of a silver lining in disasters. But the problem is, whenever there are disasters, sometimes because people just can't take them, very often they make things worse. So a lot of times by just not accepting that disasters happen, not knowing how to deal with them positively, whenever we add negativity onto disaster, it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. So fortunately, we have great sort of psychological strategies, you know, in Buddhism to know how to deal with disaster. First of all, number one, this too will pass. And that's such a simple teaching, but just such a fantastic teaching. Whatever happens which you find painful and difficult to bear, it's not going to last forever. As Ajahn Chah told me when I was sick in hospital with typhus fever, feeling absolutely terrible, he came up and I thought he was going to cheer me up, but instead he said, typical of a great master, he said to me, "Brahm, you're either going to get better or you're going to die." And then he left to go and see someone else. His bedside manner left much to be desired, but his wisdom was perfect on the spot. And it's true. What's wrong with being sick? It's not going to last, it's going to pass. You're either going to die or you're going to get better. Actually, that's strangely reassuring. I've mentioned that to people. If you've got someone sick in hospital and you go and visit them tomorrow, please try that out. I'm going to get in trouble for that one. But it's so true. But what it meant, it's going to pass. It's not going to be forever. So those of you who are in grieving about someone who has actually died, it's not going to last. It too will pass. Those people who are worried about their livelihood because there's been an earthquake or there's been a sort of an oil spill, it will pass. You know it passes. And those people who are in prison, you go and visit prisoners in jail, that's a wonderful thing. It's going to pass. You're not a prisoner. It's only a temporary thing. So don't think that, you know, because you're in jail for 1, 2, 3 years, that you're a prisoner. It's only just a thing you just are for a short while. It's a wonderful thing to know the day will come when you're not in jail anymore. You know, the day will come when the pain has disappeared. It will pass. But the most important thing about that teaching, this too will pass, when you're not in trouble, when you're happy, when you're prosperous, when there are no oil spills, when there's plenty of fish in the sea, when you're having a wonderful time with your partner, when you're healthy, when your monastery is thriving, this too will pass. That's why when people, I ask them, you know, the usual, "How are you doing?" And they say, "Oh, pretty well." I say, "It won't last." And you think it's a joke. I'm just teaching you Buddhism, Dharma. And it's really true, and it's important to understand that and to accept that. So when you are having a good time, please enjoy it. Make the most of it. It's not going to last. When you have got good health, it's not going to last. You know that. So when you are wealthy, it's not going to last. You better put the donation in soon. And so what it really means is you make the best, the most, of when things are going well in your life. Otherwise, even prosperity, health and happiness, if you don't make use of them, it's a disaster. Life goes by and you've had all these opportunities and you've let them go. You haven't really sort of lived life. Now that's a great disaster as far as I'm concerned. And I do many, many funeral services. And sometimes people think that death is tragic. Car accident, heart attack when they're only sort of 19 years of age. And I look, and that's not tragic. Dying at 19 is not tragic. It's what they've done in those 19 years could be tragic or beautiful. It's the quality of life, what they've done in that life. That's where tragedy or beauty lie. So I look at life in a totally different way. Why can't we look at life in a different way? It's the journey which is the beautiful part. The destination, death, we're all going to get there sooner or later, some sooner, some later. But it's what we're doing in the meantime. That's the most important part, the journey. So if someone has actually died and they're even 5 years of age, but they've lived a beautiful life, well done, great, beautiful, that inspires me. When some JoJo's lived 90 years of age, they've just been just so selfish, so mean, never done anything for anybody, just screwed everybody as much as they can. It's a person like that, that's a tragedy. What a waste of a life. So, for me, though, the tragedies in life are just when we don't know how to deal with life. And this too will pass is a beautiful way of dealing positively with life. When you're in pain, difficulty, tragedy, you know it's going to disappear, but when things are going well, please remember that too. Second thing about dealing with the tragedies of life is that sometimes just leave them alone. They usually fix themselves up if you give a little bit of time. Yeah, I think they've got to sort of cap that oil spill or something, but you know, the oil, I'm not quite sure how this happens, but I'm sure there's some positive aspect to that. Just I'm not sure. I know about the volcanoes sort of in Iceland, or especially the volcanoes which used to happen in Indonesia. They put all this beautiful stuff into the ground and makes the places like Java more fertile. I just know when there was huge floods when I was in Thailand. You know, when the, for those of you who know the northeast of Thailand, when the bridge between Ubon and Warin was actually flooded, it was about 1 meter of water above the bridge. I had to cross that in a boat, I remember once, to go and see Ajahn Chah. Many people actually died on that journey. It was pretty scary journey because the current was so fast. But even though many, many of the rice farmers had all their fields flooded and they couldn't get a rice crop that year because all the rice was washed away, they didn't mind. They said next couple of years, next 3 or 4 years, we won't have to buy fertilizer because the floods would actually put unused sort of topsoil onto their rice fields. There was always something positive about, you know, what other people called a tragedy. And those are the sorts of things which, you know, you realize that sometimes just let it happen. Just like when you have fevers sometimes. A fever is actually, you know, if there's the way the body deals with infections, and if you let, especially kids, have those infections and fevers, that makes them stronger and they're much healthier later on in life. So sometimes we interfere too much. But anyway, one of the great stories for dealing with tragedies and difficulties, instead of jumping up and down and getting upset and making matters worse, it's a story which I wrote about in my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, which was actually published in one of the big Thai papers just before the Red Shirts started doing their stuff in Bangkok. Because people were wondering, how can we deal with this problem? And they put this in the newspaper. They said, Ajahn Brahm's story of the drinking tea when there's no way out. And that story was told to me, a brilliant strategy for dealing with disasters. When this fellow school teacher told me that he was in the British Army during the Second World War and he was sent to Burma. He was in the jungles. He was not really a professional soldier. He was scared out of his wits. And he went on a patrol with a small group of soldiers into the jungle and stumbled into a huge number of Japanese troops. They had a scout, and the scout came back to report that they were totally surrounded, vastly outnumbered. And this was Burma, Second World War, when people play for keeps. Imagine that scenario, thousands of miles from home, surrounded, outnumbered. What would you do? He said even though he was very timid before, he had this surge of heroism. And if anyone, if you speak to soldiers who've been in battle, no one knows who's going to be the hero and who's going to be the coward. Even these really tough guys, they lose it sometimes. And people they least expect will do the heroic thing. And he wanted to be the hero. He decided, he asked his captain, look, let's try and fight our way out. Even though the odds are just impossible. Who knows? One of us might get through. And if we don't get through, at least we die fighting. We may be able to take some of those enemy troops into death with us. Let's fight our way out. And what did the captain say? No, we will not fight our way out. We will all sit down and have a cup of tea. It was the British Army, after all. And he thought, this is absolutely crazy. How could anyone think of having a cup of tea in the jungle, at war, surrounded by the enemy, vastly outnumbered, about to die? And he thought this was the most stupid thing he'd ever heard in his whole life. But this was army at war, and orders have to be followed. So even he thought this was madness. Together with a few other soldiers, they brought up some water and started making a cup of tea. And before they finished drinking that tea, the scout came back and said, put away all the stuff quickly. The enemy's moved, there's a way out. We can crawl through. And that's what they did. They all escaped with no injuries. And that soldier, then when he was an elderly teacher, he said he owed his life to the wisdom of that captain. Not once, but many times. He'd been in many disasters, most notably the time he said when he had cancer. When the doctor said there was no way out, it's terminal, you're going to die. What did he do? I know that so many people actually, they go to all these alternative cures. They clutch at straws. They have hopes which are totally irrational. But what did he do? He just sat down and had many cups of tea. He relaxed and stopped worrying. If that happens, that happens. There's nothing to do, then do nothing. And he survived. Maybe in all those antioxidants in the tea, I don't know. But he survived. But he said that that attitude to disastrous situations, when there's nothing to do, he could actually see there's nothing worth doing. So stop jumping up and down and making things worse. Stop stressing out. Stop getting angry. Stop exacerbating the situation. Look, when there's nothing to do, just sit down and have a cup of tea and do nothing. And that's why the Thai newspaper said, look, there's nothing we can do right now. You know, this is going to happen. So let's all just keep cool and have cups of tea. Now, it would have been wonderful if they'd have kept drinking their tea. They must have run out of hot water or something, I don't know. But sometimes when there's nothing to do, that's one of the best options. Which means that the disaster may be happening around us, but we're very peaceful. And the beautiful thing about that simile is to know that, yeah, this too will pass. Things change. There may be an option. There may be something to do. Somebody comes up with a bright idea. Well, things change and you can be effective and you can stop that disaster or at least ameliorate it. Then is the time to do something. But the trouble with human beings, whenever there's a disaster, we just have to do something. And a lot of times we just make it worse. We just don't know how to sit still and have a cup of tea when there's nothing to do, even though it looks like we're about to die. And that strategy is a beautiful strategy, and it's something which I've used a lot in my life. When there's a problem with the bhikkhuni ordination, when there's nothing to do, just sit down, it will pass. When there's problems with anything else in life, sickness, difficulties, oh, just leave it alone for a while, solutions will come up. But you don't worry about things. Because if you worry about things, it just means you're wasting your energy. You're just getting all tensed up. You probably get angry at other people. You just actually delay possible solutions. I don't know how many times this has happened to you. There's a big problem. I just learned to leave it alone. I can't think of a solution, just leave it. And if a solution doesn't happen by itself, it doesn't heal itself, when I'm not thinking, worrying about it, then these ideas come up. And some of them are brilliant ideas. And okay, yeah, but if I'm worrying about it, those ideas never come up. I need to sit down and have cups of tea and just relax and do nothing for ideas to come up. So in disastrous situations, if one really wishes to learn the middle way, sometimes it means sitting down and doing nothing, being peaceful and waiting to see what can be done. And if there's nothing to do, do nothing. Talking about my predecessor, Ajahn Jacaro, I remember once he really, really impressed me when in our monastery in Thailand, I think he was up the top of the line, and this supporter came in while we were having our meal, flailing her arms up and down, shouting at the top of her voice. She was obviously disturbed. Something had really affected her, but we really couldn't make much sense of what she was saying. And then I figured out what she was saying. You know, she calmed down a little bit, although she was still very agitated, and she burst out that one of our chief supporters had shot herself that morning, committed suicide, and she had found the body. And when I realized what had happened, my goodness, this is a suicide, one of our supporters. And I saw, you know, the head monk, Ajahn Jacaro, just look up and then put his head down and carry on eating. I thought, my goodness, what are you doing? This is not a time to eat. You know, someone has just shot themselves and this poor girl has actually found a body. She's disturbed. You know, why are you so concerned about your food for, you greedy monk? I know food's important for a monk. We only eat once a day in Thailand, but crikey, I mean, this lady needs your attention. And I was really upset at him for about 2 or 3 minutes. And he just carried on eating. And this lady, because she wasn't being given any attention at all, started to calm down. And when she was sitting peacefully, then that great monk Ajahn Jacaro put down his spoon, stopped eating and said, "What's happened?" That was a brilliant example of emotional intelligence, of how to deal with a tragedy. He had allowed her to calm down, first of all, by not buying into her emotional distress, calming down. And then, when she was in a position that she to listen and to be helped, then he started talking to her. And I thought, that's brilliant psychology. He knew just how to leave things alone, let things be and be still for a while. He wasn't drinking tea, he was eating his mangoes or whatever it was we were eating that day. But it was a brilliant doing nothing, allowing situations to settle, allowing all of the sort of the stupidity of rage, of inner turmoil to settle down. And then when there was something he could do, he stopped his eating and paid attention to her. It was brilliant, and I really respect what he did there. And that's actually how we can deal with some of the tragedies. Sometimes when there's a tragedy, when we run around and panic, we make things even worse. I don't know how many people have told, whether it's in a bushfire board, or I remember that when we were doing the first years at Bodhinyana Monastery, when we didn't really know what we were doing with building, we decided to build an ablution block on top of a rock. Instead of just building a bit higher, we decided to try and blow the rock up. So it was Ajahn Jacaro and me and another guy playing with jet ignite. Really good fun, you know, boys being boys, you know, setting explosions and stuff like that. It was really good fun. It was like fireworks night, and you can't do that these days with terrorists, but it was really good fun when you were just a monk with playing with jet ignite and stuff like that. But anyway, we did that. And we were actually told, look, once that thing was lit, you never run. You always walk to behind the tree. Because it's when people run and panic, that's when they fall over, break their leg, and that's when they get blown up. It's the same when you're sort of fleeing from a bushfire. You never run, because that's when you fall over. If you're driving your car, drive slowly, because that's when you crash. It's all that panic which makes a big problems. And so often in disasters, it's when people learn how they panic. And because we know how to go slowly, we know the relationship, what we have with what we're doing, we don't panic, we don't get so upset, then that's why people survive. So this is an important thing to remember, that as far as disasters are concerned, number one, there's always a sort of positive side to it. You see the bigger picture. Sometimes that means just doing nothing, and when there's something to do, do it, but don't panic. And it's amazing just that how you can help so many people not have injuries, not have stress, be more effective in difficult situations, and when there are disasters, to keep their cool and be able to sort of be much more effective. This is not resilience in the sense of being a tough guy, it's being a wise guy. Buddhism always recognizes that wisdom is the power, not just inner strength. It's wisdom, seeing what to do and having these emotional strategies, this emotional intelligence, to be able to deal with anything. And that emotional intelligence to deal with all the crises and disasters of life, that's all gained. That wisdom is gained by putting your attention not in the disaster, not in yourself, but in that space between you. It's the relationship we have to the death, the relationship we have to the loss, the relationship we have to the seeing that all of our hard work is destroyed by an earthquake, to see the relationship we have, to see the home in which we grew up all destroyed by some tsunami. Now look at just what happened to those people in those tsunami areas. I've been to visit them, and it's amazing just their resilience, but it's not their strength. It's their wisdom, their attitude towards life, things which would destroy us. Some of those people, they just, well, this is what happens. And they just put it behind them, keep on building, living for the future, never worrying about the past. It's a very beautiful attitude. And we think, how the heck can you do that? You can do that because people follow that middle way. Tsunamis happen, deaths happen. But what are we doing about that? What's our relationship to it? What is happening in that space in between me and what I have to experience in life? That's where action is. And if we can put the positive things in that space between us and whatever we have to experience, things like sort of kindness, wisdom, sometimes peace, just leaving it alone for a while, then you find that in that space between you and your life, that is where truth lies. That is where you can actually make a difference. As I said at the beginning, you can't control the world. You can't avoid all these disasters which happen to you in your life, which happen to places in this world. You can't control the disasters, but you can control your reactions to them. The way you look at them, the way you make use of them. And if you know how to do that, they're not disasters anymore, just opportunities for spiritual growth. So that's the talk this evening, dealing with disasters. Very good. So has anyone got any comments or questions or complaints about the talk tonight, the three C's? Oops. You got a question? Hello.
Did I miss something or fall asleep? Did you mention that there was actually
a silver lining? I didn't catch what the silver lining was about the oil full of carbon, that the disaster. No, just the environmental, the more focus, the more incentive to have energy which is not fossil fueled, to make it even more clear that not just fossil fuels are running out, but extracting them is getting even more dangerous. And even though that people promise that they have the technological savvy to extract fossil fuels from the most difficult places, the more difficult it is, the more prone it is to such events. So it's just making it more important, more incentive to have alternative forms of energy. So that gives an incentive, that's a positive side of that. For those of people like me who come from England, like fish and greasy chips and greasy fish, there are many greasy fish from there too, no? That's only joking about. They can always see something positive, whatever happens. What was that story I was saying to the monks? It was a fellow from Indonesia. He was going to come and visit, but apparently he can't come now. But when I was in Indonesia last March, you know, he was saying that he told me that he was working for a fellow in Indonesia, and he must have upset his boss really big time, because he was summoned to his boss's office and the boss pulled a gun and put it on his head. "You resign your resignation right now, I'm going to blow your brains out." Now that's you think Donald Trump is tough, but this guy is just out Trump's Trump. You know, it really meant you're fired. But anyhow, you know, this was such a devastating blow, a disaster, because this was his livelihood. He didn't have any other job, and he had a family with a wife and two young kids. He signed a resignation and left, and he thought this was the end of his life. You know, how can he get going again? But, you know, that gave him the incentive. The only thing he could do, wouldn't ever get hired anymore by anybody, not with the recommendation of that boss. So he only had one thing to do, start his own business. And he was very successful, and now he's a very wealthy man. And he said, "Thank you for putting that gun on me. If you hadn't have done that, I'd still be working for you." And so, you know, sometimes these things happen. It might feel like it's a disaster, but it's an incredible silver lining. And he's almost like thankful. But I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't do that to people you work who work for you out of compassion. So that was just a very strange and very surprising thing. But it actually worked for him. So there was a silver lining there. Who knows? Anyway, so thank you. Did that answer your question, sort of? Very good. So, any other questions? No? Oh, there's one at the back. I can see the hand because I can't see the person. Yeah? Yeah, I say when a person dies, they go to heaven. Do you believe there is a place called heaven? Yeah, Perth has got three heavens. They've got Dhammasara Nuns Monastery, Serpentine Monastery, and this centre here in Nolamara. There's a three heavens you can go to. But yeah, actually, the Buddhists believe in reincarnation, in rebirth. So we don't believe that once you die, that's it, you're gone, poof, and that's the end of you. No, of course, you know, out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences. Somebody sent me what I call bad science, when somebody was saying in some sort of magazine that when you die, your brain is suffused with mostly carbon dioxide, they were saying, but many other chemicals. And that explains these near-death experiences. It doesn't explain the near-death experiences, because people have these near-death experiences just way after that death has happened. They've been dead for a long time. The brain is not functioning. And it's not fantasies. They see and hear things which actually happen. So it's actually totally true. There's this one extreme case. The person had been on the operating table. They'd been dead for about 5 or 6 minutes. And they said they floated up. And what they saw a tennis shoe on the ledge of the window high up. And this is in the operating table, operating theater, like a tennis shoe. And as soon as they said that, I thought, "You're crazy. There can't be a tennis shoe up there." You know, because how would it get there? But nevertheless, she insisted it was, so they got a ladder, because they couldn't actually see it from down on the floor. They got the ladder, and there was one up there. And that was really convincing, the tennis shoe one. That, you know, how on earth, because they couldn't see it from, you know, the doctors and nurses. It was actually on the ledge, on the high window, and there was one up there. No one knows how it got there, but it was true. So these are things which you can't explain just by some fantasy or caused by the brain being suffused with these chemicals. So it's true. So that it's pretty much proven that, yeah, you consciousness continues after you die. So if it can continue after you die, what happens next? Either you get reborn in this realm or go to a heaven realm. But the thing with the Buddhist heaven realms is you make your heaven. It's a mind-made realm. So because the Buddhists understand the power of the mind, much more so than many other religions, because we meditate all the time, we know what the mind can do. It can create a world which you can stay in for a long time. So you make your heaven however long you think you deserve. That's our Buddhist heaven realms. So in my heaven realm, fish and chip shops, Jimi Hendrix, none of these sort of harps and ambrosia. That sucks. You know. And none of these people in white clothes, you know, just some nice brown robes. That's from my heaven. Go on. Yeah.
What happens to the reincarnation? Like, how there'd be less humans to reincarnate to? So, what would happen?
Well, actually, put it the other way. You're actually asking about reincarnation. You said if we limited the population, then there won't be so many sort of like rooms at the inn for people to get reborn into. But it works the other way, that why is there such a huge increase in the human population now? Where did all these extra human beings come from? And it's an obvious answer. Just because there's been a huge increase in the human population, what has decreased? The animal population. So that many people sitting here this evening... Maybe not this head here, but no, in the other sort of, the other religions, you know. No, there's a lot of people that actually were sort of animals in their previous life.
So are you saying that if the human population decreased, then there would be more going into animals?
That's right, because we'd obviously be using less habitat. And never demean the animals, they are far closer to human beings than people believe. And I've mentioned this, if you want to sort of see something spooky, when you go back home, get on Google, Alex the Parrot. A-L-E-X, the Parrot. And have a look at some of the movies of Alex. He can speak. He can have a conversation with people. This is not Disney. This is he actually died recently. He's got some disciples, and he has. I mean, I haven't seen this one. I've seen some of the original ones, and it's spooky. This is a parrot, a bird, and he's actually speaking and he's having conversations with people. And what actually happened? I'm going a bit late here, but he was an African grey parrot. Some people in St. Louis, United States, they were psychologists specializing in teaching children with learning disorders how to speak. And they decided to use the same techniques for teaching kids with disorders how to speak English to try that on a parrot. And that parrot learned a whole vocabulary and started using it intelligently. And you see the videos on YouTube, Alex the Parrot, and look at it for yourself. It's actually spooky. But they said that before he died, they tried it on other African parrots. But now Alex was number one. He was the first. And he would actually tell the other parrots off, "You're not pronouncing it properly." This was a parrot talking to a parrot. Now that really showed, that's one of the biggest evidence there of like just the intelligence and the just how close we are to the animal kingdom and how close the animals are to us. And far closer than, we all know that sort of we share just, 99.5% of the genes of a chimpanzee. But we also share a lot more than that as well. So anyway, go on this evening or tomorrow, get Alex the Parrot. It's spooky, but it's great fun. And it's not an animation. It's not sort of, you know, this is real. Another question. Okay, last question, because I'm going on late. You're getting overtime. I don't get extra pay for this, you know. You want to will yourself to come back as an animal. I know that somebody here years ago, they said they wanted to come back as a dog. And I said, why do you want to come back as a dog? And they say, because I don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. I can sleep around all day, and I get really good food, and I get petted, and I've got no worries, no responsibilities at all. I want to come back as a dog. And then I said, don't you realize that, you know, in the first few weeks of a dog's life, they're taken to the vet for the operation? And they said, I don't want to be a dog in my next life. So what do you want to be? A cat. They also have to go to the vet as well. Do you want to go to the vet? A big cat, like a tiger. In Africa, they end up being in prison all day in the zoo. Being poked by people all the time. Is that where you spend your life in a zoo, a cage? No, anyway, it's much better being a human being. Do you reckon? You don't want to be a human again? Okay, well, anyone's got their own choice. Anyway, that's enough for this evening, so thank you for listening.